Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue the exploration of the cultures of consciousness. Feels like I haven't been on the show for a little bit. Been bumps in the road, hurricanes, Thanksgiving, etc., etc. But it's good to be here. And as some of you know, I went back to school recently, and so I spent a couple of years of being a graduate student, which is kind of amusing in my long in the tooth years. But pretty cool. And one of the high points was a class I got to take with a professor of Buddhism named Ann Klein, and we did a wonderful class reading. An author we'll talk a bit more about later for this program, Longchenpa. But what was really interesting about the course was it was in a religious studies department, in a secular department in a secular university, a university or a department within which the Christians who were there, and there were people who were Christians who were faculty members, you know, they had to be very careful about how they wove theology into their study of religion, because it's not a theological school. It roots itself in the secular. But it was interesting inside, during Ann Klein's course, I kind of realized that she was really teaching as a Buddhist teacher. She had gotten her PhD from the University of Virginia, which had a very traditional program that was kind of like a version of a program that you would get if you were a Tibetan scholar working in a Gelugpa monastery, in Tibet back in the day. And so she'd gone through this process. She'd met lamas. She had deepened her study. And then somewhere along the way, her class became really more of a Buddhist class in Buddhism than a kind of secular class in Buddhism. And this wasn't just about her class, but really about a very interesting story about Buddhism in the American Academy, which has always had a much more interesting, nuanced flavor to it than a lot of the other traditions that are represented in school. And one of the authors that we read was a fellow named David Germano, who's with us today. Very happy to have him on the program. And, I've been interested in figuring out, like, what's going on with these sort of Buddhist scholars and how they work inside and outside and through and with the situation of being a scholar. And recently I was reading about a new center that was set up at the University of Virginia, where Dr. Germano teaches, a new center for contemplative sciences or contemplative studies. And I was like, hey, this is all coming together. We're going to figure out what's going on here. We're going to scratch the surface of what's happening, what's changing inside scholarship, which can be so fuddy-duddy and dry and rooted in materialism and secular approaches, as Buddhism and other contemplative sciences and practices gain more and more credibility, more and more cultural power, more and more cultural authority, because all sorts of things are happening. So I'm really happy that Dr. Germano agreed to be with us today. But before we bring him on, we'll invite our co-host here, Maja Daou. Maja, how's it going?
It's going good, Eric. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I'm hanging in there.
And,
so did you ever study Buddhism formally?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I was talking to you about how my mom actually lived in Tibet for several years, and my older sister was born in the Himalayan mountains, right on the border of India and Tibet, and I was conceived there. But I did. I studied with B. Allen Wallace and Vesna Wallace were two of my professors. B. Allen Wallace is out of the University of Santa Barbara Law, and he has a center set up, and his wife, Vesna Wallace, at the time had just completed a translation of the Kala Chakra Tantra.
Right.
Yeah.
It's funny because it seems like even when you study Buddhism in a traditional framework, most of the people who are teaching it to you have some investment in it or some interest in it or have been changed by it in some way, even if they wouldn't call themselves Buddhist. There's something almost about just even reading the text, reading the material, wrestling with the philosophical ideas, even if you're not meditating, that right. kind of does something to you.
It's funny how they'll read books hour upon hour, but then they won't sit down to meditate.
You know, for sure. Well, let's bring Dr. Germano on the show. David, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Well, you know, the more I look at all the various projects and practices you're involved with, there's more and more topics. But I thought I would just start out with a little bit of your kind of your core scholarship. If you could tell us a little bit about your interest in the Dzogchen tradition in particular, and the works of Longchenpa, and sort of presumably that's really what drew you into this world and kind of formed the backbone of your scholarship. And since Longchenpa is a wonderful writer, a completely amazing religious genius that people don't know so much about unless they're really studying Tibetan Buddhism fairly intensely, if you could just sort of talk a little bit about this, your core work in this area.
Sure. When I first started getting heavily involved in Tibetan Buddhism, I was about 21 or so, and I remember at that point I'd grown up in northern Indiana in the shadow of the Golden Dome in Notre Dame, so I wasn't particularly exposed very much to Asian culture or Buddhist philosophy and teaching and so forth, and so I didn't really know a whole lot. And I remember I just decided to take a plunge and get involved in Buddhism because it attracted me on different levels, and I was searching around and thinking about what in Tibet was I most interested by. And I remember when I first went to the University of Wisconsin to begin a doctoral program there, I was studying Tibetan over the summer before the program started, and someone was reading a book, and I asked them what it was, and I looked at it, and it was a translation of one of Longchenpa's great classics. And I remember thinking, I'm just going to go ahead and study that for the next 20 years. And I did on the basis of about a three-minute glance at the book, and it turned out that that was correct. And I think what attracted me was probably two things. One is I've always been interested in the border between poetry and philosophy and the way in which aesthetics, poetry, art, beauty is also a rigorous way of inquiry, a rigorous way of thinking about your experience and thinking about the world. And so I've always been more drawn to scholars that try to think about the nature of human experience and epistemology and the world around us and so forth through the medium of more poetic types of reflections rather than logical or analytical. And that kind of expresses the genius of Longchenpa, who was a great systematic philosopher but also one of Tibet's greatest poets. And the other thing about the Dzogchen tradition, which is what expresses Longchenpa's most basic kind of commitments in terms of his interest in the broad spectrum of Buddhist traditions, is that it's a tradition, when you look at its overall history, not just looking at one part, but its overall history and how it developed over time, people often think Dzogchen is about simplicity and that it's about talking about naked experience and non-conceptuality and so forth. And that's there, without a doubt, but that's not simply the Dzogchen in which Longchenpa is immersed. Rather, what happens as Dzogchen develops over time is it becomes this really fascinating philosophy and contemplative system that's balanced between simplicity and complexity, and that spends its most sustained time trying to look at the border between those two and understand what happens when complexity dissolves into simplicity and how does complexity come back out of simplicity. And I think for me, that's why I ultimately became most fascinated in terms of Indian and Tibetan Buddhist systems with Dzogchen.
Well, that reminds me a little bit of a not dissimilar situation with Zen, particularly, which of course has its own kind of intriguing, historical tendrils into Dzogchen, depending on who you talk to. But people have this idea, particularly in the West, of this emphasis on bare simplicity, on pure experience, on no discursive elaboration. But of course, the Zen tradition is immensely rich with textuality, even compared to other veins of Japanese Buddhism. It's rich with commentary and complex developments, and yet it has within it this kind of gesture, this sort of recurrent move of freshness and a kind of poetics there. And it's even interesting, I mean, even if you don't study Zen, since it's often something that people know a bit more about, although of course Dzogchen now is quite, at least some version of it or some idea of it is popular among people who are interested in Buddhism. I'm wondering if you have a sense of that kind of that relationship between the two traditions, not necessarily historically, but just the way in which they appeal or they attract, partly through this apparent simplicity of experience, and yet they bring with them such immense richness and complexity.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of similarity between Dzogchen on the one hand and Chan traditions in China and Zen traditions in Japan. And it revolves more around the earlier Dzogchen traditions, which tend to focus more on these poetic meditations upon the nature of experience and simplicity and so forth. And I think what happens, and where the two are very different in a way, is that traditions define themselves not only in what they embrace, but also in what they reject, or what they essentially go beyond. And even when you reject something, you're kind of defining yourself in terms of that rejection, in terms of that absence, in terms of what you self-consciously left behind. And what Dzogchen left behind, or what Dzogchen transmuted, or Dzogchen rejected, but then engaged in a complex relationship, is Tantric Buddhism. And that really wasn't the way in which Zen developed over time. And I think
that's a good point. I wonder if you could just take a moment, and for folks that maybe don't know about it, if you could just give, like, I know this is like kind of a difficult thing to do, but if you could give a quick definition of what is Dzogchen, like what does it comprise?
Dzogchen itself. Well, so Dzogchen basically starts in the 8th and 9th century, and it develops for a couple of centuries. It's supposed to be an Indian tradition, but it's pretty clearly something that's born and nurtured within Tibet from the late 8th century forwards. And during that time, the first couple centuries, it's defined by being something, when you look at the textual traditions, it's a lot of very beautiful poetic meditations. But what you don't really get is systematic thought. You don't get long explanations of, like, how we view the world, or how our senses work, or the way in which the human mind processes things, or the nature of the body, and all these kinds of things. So early on, it's more poetic reflection on the nature of experience of a very rarefied type. And the practices in early traditions, they don't even really articulate what you might do. There's a lot of paradoxical language that seems to suggest there's no practice at all, or there's nothing to do, or you just have to let go, and so forth. And so a lot of Tibetans interpreted that literally and said, well, if there's nothing to do, then there's not much of a tradition there. Although we all know that just because a tradition says something doesn't mean that's actually what they do. We're always saying things that mean something else when you inspect it on the ground. So the tradition...
Look at Christianity, right?
Yeah, right. Well, like everything, like our relationships, like our political perspectives,
right.
We're always saying things, and when you view it out of context, you might say, oh, it's a very strange thing to say. But in context, it's actually very clear what they say. So I think these traditions were certainly doing contemplative practices, but the contemplative practices seem to have largely been things about quietly sitting, cultivating an awareness of your awareness, watching the nature of your mind, and so forth, rather than complex projects that involved visualizations and manipulating interior energies in your body and so forth. And that was what the early Dzogchen was about, these poetic...
Well, but there are some of those things thrown in. Like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I kind of found out about Dzogchen, one of the things that I came to it through was the prostration practices that they would do, which certainly are pretty physical. But I know that's not necessarily a component for all the practitioners. But it, like you said, there's variations, so it'll include some of those kind of things too.
Well, you got 1,200 years, and so it all depends on which year you're asking the question about.
Right.
There's no way that anybody could say that it's clear that prostrations were involved with anything under the Dzogchen rubric in the early centuries. And
right.
What happens then after those first couple of centuries is that the early Dzogchen has like two strong emphases. One is it rejects everything. It negates everything. It's like this transcendental deconstruction. And so it's kind of like Madhyamaka philosophy in Indian Buddhism and so forth. So there's this thing that we just want to go beyond thoughts, go beyond concepts, that none of these things make sense in our experience. We have to deconstruct them all and get back to this naked, direct experience. And there's that negative language, but there's also a really positive language. There's a language of some type of inner divinity and inner Buddha nature and inner luminosity, that if you just let go, if you just relax, that this primordial experience would kind of flow forth. And so there's this very rich positive language and this very systematic kind of negative language as well. And that's what the nature of early Dzogchen is about. And one of the things it negates is Tantric Buddhism. And Tantric Buddhism is this form of Buddhism that emerges in the 6th century forwards in India, that's very, very complex, dense ritual systems, really complex visualizations of deities, manipulation of internal energies to try to contemplatively reduplicate the experience of sexuality and death, and transform these kinds of strong energies and experiences in the service of enlightenment. And Dzogchen essentially negates those practices and negates that whole project of transformation. Instead of transformation, it wants you just to let go. Instead of the transformed violence or transformed sexuality, it kind of advocates a very naturalistic perspective. You know, we're already there. Just figure out how to let go. Figure out how to relax back into these natural rhythms and so forth. But what happens in a couple centuries, by the 11th century, it completely changes. And what it does is it goes back to everything it rejected, all that tantric practices and ideas that it threw out. It goes back and it begins to pull them back in. But when it pulls them back in, it doesn't just pull them back in unchanged. It pulls them back in across this boundary that they had created, this boundary of negation and rejection. And as the tantric stuff gets pulled in, it breaks apart into pieces. And a lot of it gets thrown out, and the parts that get retained get transformed in accordance with these principles of simplicity, naturalness, spontaneity, etc. And that's the second kind of great form of Dzogchen that's very, very different than the earlier forms of Dzogchen. And that's what really Longchenpa is the great apostle of.
Wow, that was a very clarifying, wonderful explanation that put a lot of things in in perspective. That was very helpful. How do you see? I mean, to kind of shift it a little bit, is how do you see your role as a scholar of this material, in the sense that you find yourself between, you know, scholarly demands? Some of your students are interested in this stuff on a personal level, on a philosophical level, as well as a scholarship level. And then at the same time, you're also dealing with lamas. You're dealing with translation issues. You're dealing with practices that are on the borderline of secrets, or things that are that you definitely need to be in the right place to be able to articulate correctly. So you're involved in a really interesting kind of negotiation, and I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, since you've just given us a wonderful flavor of your teaching, of how you see your role in terms of this material and weaving it into our world today.
Well, so personally, I don't really feel many internal conflicts, and I'll give you an example. A lot of people will always ask me, for example, are you a Buddhist? And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. In fact, I spend no time thinking about that. And one of my colleagues who teaches Christian theology has a great kind of answer for that, which is people will ask him, hey, are you Christian? And he'll say, Christianity is what I choose to be confused about. And, you know, Buddhism is something that I have a lifelong involvement with. Does that mean I'm Buddhist? I mean, honestly, I often used to tell students that once I figure out whether I'm human or not, I'll start thinking about whether I'm Buddhist, which basically, those kinds of definitions and boundaries at the personal level don't really mean much to me. Buddhism is without a doubt a religion. People who say it's not are just smoking crack. I mean, the idea that Buddhism is a philosophy, Buddhism is a rational way of life, and Christianity is a religion, that's just absurd. And there's no serious scholar who talks that way. So, but, you know, Buddhism is also a philosophy. It's a series of concepts and ways of viewing the world. It's also a way of life. It's a series of practices of the self, practices in terms of your relationships with others and so forth, which we could call contemplation, we could call meditation, we could call ritual. It's, you know, doesn't really matter in some ways. And those are things that we can be interested by. We can try them on. We can potentially immerse ourselves in the context and so forth. But you don't have to necessarily get traumatized over issues at the personal level of being Buddhist or being a scholar. For me, there's an absolute continuity with all of that. I'm a great believer in the transformative power of scholarship, and I'm a great believer in the power of historical work. And at the same time, my early commitments were always to Buddhist philosophy and to Buddhist contemplation, and I have really strong commitments to those. I mean, I would say that I view the world much more from a Buddhist conceptual framework than I do from Euro-American systems. I've spent a lot more time in Buddhist frameworks. And I think a lot of these Buddhist practices are potentially very transformative for us in various sectors of our society. At the same time, I think contemporary academic practices and how we do historical analysis and how we look at religious traditions in the context of people's lives and people's communities, these are extraordinarily powerful and extraordinarily important tools and approaches. These are all valuable things, and I just don't experience the tension that some people experience in terms of moving back and forth or feeling like you're wearing two different hats. I'm always wearing the same hat, and I just think the important issue is integrity. What integrity? What are your values in doing this work, and what matters to you, and why are you doing this, and is your behavior and your actions aligned with those values? That's the question to ask ourselves, whether we're doing scholarship in a classroom, or we're off meditating someplace, or we're studying in a traditional context from a Buddhist Lama. Now, the other issues you raise are, they're ethical issues. They're not necessarily issues that you're having to resolve in terms of your own self-identity and values, but rather the values that you place in terms of your relationships to others. So if someone teaches you something, and there's certain commitments and certain understandings that pertain to that person being willing to teach you that, well, that's an ethical issue in terms of your relationship to that person and your relationship to the community and the culture from which that person comes. And that's a very important thing, regardless of what you might think yourself about the issue. So I've spent much of my adult life in Tibet. I mean, I've been going there since I was 22 years old, and I'm pretty much there every year, and some years I'm there for, you know, three or four times. So, and I've spent a lot of time working in traditional Buddhist contexts, monasteries and hermitages, and for the last 15 years I've spent a lot of time outside of the monasteries and hermitages doing things that have nothing whatsoever to do with Buddhism. And the thing that I've seen in terms of Buddhist monasteries, and I think it's important to, you know, be respectful and also be blunt, and one of the problems I see in the traditional, well, I'll say that there's three things. If I'm looking at the nature of Buddhism in Tibet, you know, it's not just external pressures from the Chinese state or from modernity or and so forth. There's an internal debate within Buddhist teachers in Tibet about what is the nature of Buddhism? What is the nature of our responsibility as individuals at this historic juncture, in this place, in this time? And people have different perspectives on it. Different lamas have different perspectives, and there are those that I have a lot more sense of kind of allegiance to. And so one tension is, what's the value of historical analysis? I mean, are our traditions, are their legitimacy based upon the literal truth of these stories that we tell about the history of these traditions and who taught what and who didn't teach what and this visionary revelation and that visionary revelation? Or is the legitimacy in terms of the teachings and the practices? Now, for us, it's an easy answer.
Well, that's a really good thing to bring up, I think, which kind of takes it out of that, you know, if you think Buddhism is a religion, you're smoking kind of sense. Because, they, you know, Buddha and Jesus, they were individuals that had that experience and then share it. So when people do, like you said, like keep it in that strictly historical, traditional context, it eliminates any chance for any individual to have any kind of unique experience through that paradigm, because they would have to kind of like do it only under those auspices and have to have like a repeat of whatever happened to like Buddha or Jesus. So I think what you said there is really important for people to understand the dynamic nature of engaging in any of those practices.
Time is a profound thing, and Buddhism has changed dramatically over time, and you don't have to undercut the philosophical or contemplative value of Buddhism to believe in the importance of understanding how it's changed over time or how it's related to an individual's life. I mean, we can't see much about the Buddha from 2,500 years out, but we can see a lot about the life of Longchenpa and a lot about the life of different Buddhist teachers over time, and I think it's extraordinarily valuable to think about those lives and think about those teachings and think about the relationship between them. Otherwise, we're just going to go astray.
Yeah, well, let me ask you another question on the historical point. Another thing that's happening with Buddhism today is, of course, its encounter with science, with neuroscience, with psychology, in all sorts of very interesting ways. And we will at some point in this conversation talk about the new Center for Contemplative Studies there and what's going on with that. And so obviously there's a great deal of activity about bringing mindfulness in and ways of reframing what meditation or contemplation is for people working today, for scientists looking at the brain, et cetera, et cetera. In that process, there's often a tendency on both sides for people to kind of erase the density, the specificity, the poetry even of the historical context. You know, Buddhism becomes a mind science. It has sets of techniques and that can be applied or reframed in our modern world, which is in love with techniques or whatever. That's a, you know, simplistic way of putting it, of course, but it's a tendency. So I'm wondering what you see as the role of historical understanding in terms of the full flowering of what Buddhism can be today, not just in terms of, you know, the sort of the work of the scholar, or the work of understanding, the work of being able to speak truly about a tradition, but even in terms of the flourishing of this clearly very significant, you know, stream of current of human experience, how history plays a role in helping us grapple with it in a more robust way.
Well, I think it relates to whether you're thinking about Buddhism as a product or a process. Are you looking at it as a product that you're trying to somehow reproduce in exactly the same way over here? Or are you looking at it as a process that you try to align yourself with and then engage in this process and see what comes out of it? And so you covered a lot of things there. You started off with science and the humanities, then you ended by talking about the role of history in relationship to how Buddhism is changing or how it might transplant another culture and so forth. So let me start with the science part, and I'll come back to the second part. So science and religion, you know, it's a long-standing problem in our culture, and it continues to be one. And science and the humanities, another long-standing problem. It's like schizophrenia in the academy. Scientists doing this thing, humanities doing that thing. How do they relate to each other? So when people start doing like Mind and Life and these other kinds of initiatives, neuroscience, looking at how we can take scientific methodologies and try to assess contemplative practices and experience and understand what makes it tick, what's the biological mechanism, what's the neural mechanism, what's the psychological mechanism, what kind of outcomes, if you do a study in context, might you expect or are we seeing in terms of these contemplative practices and school kids or these contemplative practices and people are trying to deal with stress and so forth. So I think that's a very powerful partnership, and I think it's particularly valuable that now we're beginning to see the contemplative practitioners themselves being given more respect and being given more of a voice in the process. But I'll tell you what, there's something missing there. It's not just about linking scientists and practitioners, because what about the humanist? Now, you were talking about context, the constitutive role of context. Lots of context. You can't pull these contemplative experiences out as if they exist somehow in the sky or if they exist out of all context. They never existed out of context. Not a single Buddhist teacher ever existed out of context. What are those contexts? The communal context. Who are they living with? How do they do these practices? Was it one person alone? Was it five people? People of the same gender? People of a different gender? Where did they do it? What was the aesthetic environment? Were they always doing it in a particular kind of aesthetic environment in terms of murals and chanting and incense and so forth, or was it in more of this kind of aesthetic environment? What was the social context? What were the mindsets of these people when they sat down to do these practices, which dramatically inform the practices? When they come out, how do they contextualize it that way and so forth? I mean, there's so many different contexts.
These are wonderful, wonderful questions. I'm so glad to hear you saying this stuff. It's something I've been wanting to hear. But we got to take a break right now, so we'll come back. We'll dive right back in after this. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Dewu on An Expanding Mind. We're talking with Professor David Germano, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dewu, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're speaking with David Germano about Tibetan Buddhism and Dzogchen and practice and scholarship and all that fun stuff. David, before the break, you were talking about context and how brutally important that is. And it's something that gets so taken out and dispelled, I believe, out of a lot of popular culture. And I'm sure over the course of history, it happens a lot too. But like, I mean, you think about someone like John Coltrane, you know, and if someone just kind of listens to a John Coltrane album and they don't know anything about his life or who he is or what was happening or what was his influences, you know, you can listen to the music and you can still kind of enjoy it. But for me, in my experience, whenever I find out about the people's lives that I love, like whether it's authors or poets or, you know, musicians, it puts an entirely different experience onto the whole thing. Just having like an ounce of context sometimes can make something kind of flower and bloom in front of you. So, I mean, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about why context is so important for like that human experience of the thing. But having to know a little bit about like what was happening there that can kind of like transcend putting it in this, like, purely, you know, kind of statistical place, you know?
Yeah. Well, we were talking right there about science and so forth. And so one way that context is important and a little bit different from just thinking about music or art or something is if we're looking at contemplation and we're asking the question, how does it work and how could it be value to us? So Buddhist in Tibet, in a particular time period and place, would bundle these contemplative systems together with each other and with other stuff in one way. And so our interest is, okay, we're not in Tibet anymore. We're going to unbundle it. We're going to break it apart, and we're going to use this piece and that piece and so forth in this context and that context. There's nothing wrong with that at all. I think that's great. But if you never understood the deep contextual relationships that constituted those contemplative practices and their meanings in the first place, then how are you going to go about an intelligent process of figuring out how these things work? And when something doesn't work the way you think it does, go back and figure out how you might reconfigure it. Maybe instead of doing one person do the practice, have five people together. Or instead of visualizing it that way, visualize it this way. If you never understood the full context in the first place. So that's one way in which it's really essential. The other thing is more of a conceptual orientation, which is I think we think context is trivial. We think it's baggage. We want to go to the profound, especially these days. We want the California weekend, you know, just go right to the profound. Skip all the crap, the cultural baggage, the trivial context, and so forth. And I think context is profound. It's not profundity versus triviality. It's all profound. And it's our failure to see that profundity that makes us think we're just going to go for the gold. I mean, Buddhism, one of its oldest saying is, samsara is nirvana, nirvana is samsara. There's no difference between the two. Well, what that means is profundity is everywhere. And so people's lives are not the trivial detritus of history from which these rich contemplative systems emerged. They're all profound. And it's we that don't see the profundity.
Well, it's interesting to take that and then turn it back and look at what the Western encounter with Buddhism has been like already, in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of what, you know, misunderstandings, some of them creative, some of them not very creative. There's a lot of superficiality. And today, I think what you're right is that we're seeing a lot of sort of extraction, you know, what techniques can be extracted in order to make, you know, global capitalism work better, and there's so much that's lost. But it's also interesting is that in some crazy messed up way, that's sort of beautiful and sort of really problematic, and it's a way also that scholars have themselves played a really instrumental role in, is that that has also been the building of a context, of a different kind of context. So it's like there is something still that's being communicated, but so much of it involves misunderstanding or distortion or this kind of greed for the profound as it leaps over, you know, all of this apparently trivial material, which isn't, you know, trivial at all. So then the question becomes for people in the West who are, you know, don't have the opportunity to go to Tibet every year, how do you see the attempt to sort of build or grow a Western context that's appropriate for Buddhism in terms of the kind of work you do, in terms of the kinds of ways that historical scholarship, you know, university practices in contemplative studies, how can they help sort of mature and richen that process, which is going to happen one way or the other anyway, which is already happening?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with misinterpretation. I mean, that's the history of human culture. We misinterpret each other, and out of that misinterpretation, we might do some very creative things. But a while back ago, you mentioned ethical issues, and I think there's real ethical issues when the misinterpretation takes place across boundaries of inequity. Tibetans are not equal to us in America. I don't need to go into the history of that. It's just the case. And so when we aggressively misinterpret across that boundary, and we tear it apart and we use things in our own way, and, you know, that can be very problematic ethically because of that boundary of inequity between us and between, in this case, Tibetans. But apart from that, misinterpretation in the sense of not understanding the context or the actual, you know, deep meaning of this and so forth can sometimes be liberating. It can sometimes make possible creative recontextualizations or distortions of the original, which end up producing something really interesting. And in the history of Tibet, there's a lot of language of fidelity. We're exactly like the Indians. We translated the Sanskrit text exactly into Tibetan. Everybody who's done Tibetan studies knows that's not true. They know that Tibetans were profoundly creative and profoundly innovative, which means they profoundly misinterpreted a lot of things. Because if you just engage in fidelity, acts of fidelity, you don't get any innovation. You get no creativity. You get no assimilation and so forth. And so I think that's our challenge right now, which is how do we become fundamentally creative, fundamentally innovative, but not become people who in a California weekend are just glancing off the surface of things with not just an interesting misunderstanding, but not even trying to understand. I wouldn't call that misunderstanding. I would call that the pretense of understanding. So you want to engage it, but, you know, innovate. And I think innovation is great, and I think we should be innovating with these traditions. I don't think that we need to be Buddhist. I think we need to understand these traditions with respect. We need to be respectful towards the communities in which they continue to be embedded. And we should feel free to experiment with these in totally different sectors and contexts than they were ever done within Tibet.
That's great. So what's a good example for you in terms of that, the kind of innovation that you're more interested in seeing happen now, you know, in contrast with the proverbial California weekend?
Well, I think these traditions are, of course, very diverse. You got dramatic visualizations, and you have deeply analytical exercises, and you got poetic reveries, and you have complex postures and new forms of breathing, quiet states of mind. I mean, it's very, very complicated. But I think in terms of looking at Buddhist contemplation, and that's very much what Sokchen's perspective is the thread of continuity that goes through all of them, is they're about coming to terms with this extraordinary capacity for awareness that we have and how we can bring it to bear upon different aspects of our life. Watch our mind, watch our bodies, watch our emotions, watch our thought process, watch our memories, watch our relationships to each other. Watch all of these things, cultivate an awareness of them, and as you cultivate an awareness of them, then you realize that these aren't natural things. They're not given things. They could be another way. And then these contemplative practices begin to offer us ways to entertain those other possibilities and explore them. So if you think about it that way, it's a little bit hard to think exactly what sector of our society or what aspect of our life is just not going to be a useful skill. And so when we think about these benefits more pragmatically, and I don't think that's the only way to approach it. Go ahead.
It's true. Like that really is a big deal, because I feel like for a lot of people, they do just want to put it in like a single aspect. Like they're like, you know, oh, I went and I did my little 10-day Vipassana retreat meditation, and now I'm cool. Like I can go back to doing whatever else it was I was doing. And they don't take the things they get in their California weekend and then put it into the rest of their lives. So, I mean, and that to me has been something that's always appealed to me about Tibetan Buddhism, is that it's, you know, really a way that you can put it into practice in everything that you do, and being able to put it, you know, take it out of that context. This is the little thing that we do when we're holy and we're meditating, but then realize, oh my God, I can use that for all the stuff that I'm doing in everything, every single thing you do.
And you ask yourself, why are you doing this? And if your goal is, I want to manage my stress, or I'm looking to try to be able to reduce my bias by noticing it and so forth, or I'm trying to have better self-regulation, you know, not kind of immediately act out in a response to emotions that rise up. It's all great. I mean, there's no problem with that. But it is different from going into this set of practices with immodest hopes. You know, you don't have to call it enlightenment. You can just say, you know, I'm looking for something more than just self-regulation or more empathy or more resiliency or more stress management. But, you know, I'd like to explore the outer limits of who I can become. And, you know, things that are rooted in our perception of suffering are rooted in our perception of the world around us. And I think one of the things that I feel very strongly about with Buddhist contemplation is that it's not simply about the transformation of your individual awareness, but ultimately it has to be about collective transformation.
I mean, I hear that in the way that you bring ethics into the conversation in a really powerful way, and I wanted to give you just also a little chance to talk a bit about. I know that you do a lot of work in Tibet and working with Tibetans and trying to figure out ways to allow them access to knowledge networks and other kinds of forms of power that are, you know, that are really productive these days. And I mean, that's clearly a really important part of the way in which you build your own gentle bridges. So what is like a project you're working on now or have been in terms of, you know, stepping out of the monastery, stepping out of just the room where you're talking with the, you know, over translation issues, where you're more richly engaging with Tibetan culture in terms of your own interests and skills?
Well, when I started getting involved in Buddhism back in my 20s, and I spent all that time in Tibet, I was a very asocial person. I was very locked into myself. And one of the things I noticed in terms of the teachers that I had the greatest admiration for over those years was they were entrepreneurs. They were people who moved out into the social domain and basically created a space for collective transformation, who took care for the world around them where it was, not simply sitting in the monasteries and saying, come to me and, you know, we'll give you this transaction, we'll do this ritual or meditation or blessing and so forth. They went out into that world, and they tried to think about that world, think about how do communities come together, what do communities need, how can we respond to those needs and so forth. And I found that really inspiring. And so at the University of Virginia, since the late 1990s, for the past 15 years or so, we've been doing extensive work in Tibetan communities. And it's not about Buddhism. It's not about meditation. Those things are problematic for, you know, various reasons back in Tibetan communities. But what it's about is thinking, how can we help Tibetans or support Tibetans that are trying to work within their own communities and with their own distinctive knowledge traditions, traditions which sometimes are Buddhist in character, other times aren't. They're oral traditions, nomadic traditions, and so forth, and help support them in their quest to sustain that knowledge, to make that those traditions and those cultural traditions thrive into the future. And so we've done work with education to employment programs, worked with our education school here to bring Tibetans over and think about how's the educational system related to employment outcomes, how could it be better. We've done work in geotourism, which is a huge, massive kind of engine of revenue production in Tibet, but it's often not really benefiting Tibetans. And so how can you have a more community-based form of tourism, tourism which respects and engages and benefits the communities and the places they visit. We've done work in participatory knowledge production, helping Tibetans use modern technologies to represent their point of view and reflect analytically about the world around them and so forth. And cultural affairs, done a program on, supported a program in helping support Tibetan women be authors and learn about how to be authors and try to raise the profile of collective awareness about the fact that women actually can write, strangely enough. Some males seem to find that astonishing. So a lot of different programs like that, and none of them have to do with Buddhism overtly, but for me they're all grounded back in that idea that ultimately you got to get out there in the world and try to understand how it's working and think about how much do I care for the people in this locality and how much do I care for their perspective and their plight and their situation and their kind of goals.
Can you just say a little bit about, because I think it's something that will be surprising to some people, about the way in which for ordinary Tibetans in Tibet or in the United States or other places just trying to, like, you know, live their lives, that the issues around Buddhism and meditation and particular Western interests in those things are probably more problematic than a lot of people would think. And in some sense, In order to develop our own, or even I'm just saying personally, my own ability to deal with the Tibetan people that I've known and have the opportunity to get to know in living in San Francisco, I also had to find my own way around assumptions I had about the role of meditation or the role of Buddhism or how things work in their lives.
Well, I think there's two sets of issues. So one set of issues that Tibetans who live in China right now, as opposed to Tibetans living in India or Nepal or in the diaspora, what they face is, of course, it's a state that is not particularly positive about religion and positive about contemplation and so forth. And so that's a problem. I mean, we can't go over there and say, hey, let's introduce contemplative practices into the school system and so forth because religion is problematic. So that's one set of problems. The other set of problems is that the Tibetan culture still has this tendency to see meditation as something that's for elites, that's for the people in the monastery, even though there's, of course, a rich tradition in Tibet of lay religious leadership and so forth. But too many people see that dichotomy. And so they might be doing practices of prayer and so forth, but the way in which contemplation and yoga has become so ubiquitous in America, in Tibet, and partially because there's that absence of a public space to think and talk about these things and so forth, you haven't really surmounted that. And so, like, for example, I was in northeastern Tibet last summer, and I was talking to a really wonderful nonprofit that was run by young Tibetan women and was trying to work on issues relating to Tibetan women and so forth. And we were talking about various things they were doing, and I was mentioning ways that we could help them. And then I said, and we could help you with contemplation. You know, if you're interested in helping empower these young women and empower them to have resiliency and courage in the face of adversity and learn how to be leaders and learn how to be active listeners and, you know, empathy and all this kind of stuff, but do so in a way that could help them insert themselves into leadership positions and so on, contemplation is an incredible resource. There are so many leadership training programs in North America that have been derived from Tibetan Buddhist contemplation. And the response was just like, oh, okay.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, thank you for doing that. That was really helpful for me, and I'm sure some of our listeners. We only have about, you know, 8 minutes left, and we haven't really talked about the Center for Contemplative Sciences at UV, which is really a sign, again, of how things are changing in terms of how our society is engaging these contemplative meditational practices, and it's, you know, you got quite a nice chunk of change there to do something really interesting. So tell me about how some of these issues that we've already been talking about in this really fascinating conversation, how they're playing out in terms of what the center is doing and what kind of role you see it playing.
Well, the center is as an idea to, you know, cultivation, it's only been about 18 months from the first moment of discussion with the donors, with Paul and Sonia Jones, to today. It's been about an 18-month process. And like I was telling you, because I've been doing so much work back in Tibet, I had really downplayed contemplation and my own background in Buddhist contemplation and philosophy and so forth. And so after we got the idea that maybe we were going to hatch some type of contemplative sciences center at the university, you know, I had the mandate to go around and represent myself as someone who had an interest and a background in these areas. And what really amazed me was how pervasive it's become over the past 15 years. I remember at one point I was talking to the dean's office in one of the larger schools, and I said I was really surprised at how many people are doing yoga, and the associate dean said, who doesn't do yoga? And I thought, well, I'll tell you, when I came to Virginia 21 years ago, a lot of people weren't doing yoga, you know? So things have really changed. There's been a sea change. And what we're trying to do at the University of Virginia, and we have a wonderful kind of seed gift, but we're going to need to raise a lot more money, is we're trying to say, here's a big public research one university, one of the best in the country. And what happens if we go systematically through the 11 schools at that university, commerce, leadership, architecture, education, nursing, medicine, arts and sciences, law, you know, engineering and so forth, and go through each one of those and think about what are the core issues in learning and research and engagement that they're doing, and how might contemplation be a potentially valuable resource to begin to think about innovation or improved efficiencies or new approaches and so forth to these fundamental challenges people are facing. And that's what we've basically been doing, going through each school, talking to the deans and the professors and students and so forth, and getting a sense of how we might thread contemplation in the distinctive culture of that area of the university. And so we're not just interested in Dzogchen or Ashtanga yoga or other really complex traditions that have come out of Asia, or they might be Catholic contemplative traditions or Islamic contemplative traditions. We're interested in those for sure, but we're not only interested in those, because we're very interested in the person who might never want to be involved with those traditions, but they face the same challenges we all face. They face challenges about emotional intelligence, or how to be more resilient, or how to deal with my stress, or how to be more empathetic, or how to have better pattern recognition, you know, and so forth, or reduce my bias. And we want to bring these principles and ideas and values and practices into their lives as well, into their cultures, into their institutions. And so we're trying to create a full spectrum approach that goes all the way to these complex mind-body traditions on the one hand, and might go down to some very simple principles completely divested of any relationship to the original context. And we value both of those. I think one of the distinctive things that we're doing is we have a great religious studies department. We have a lot of specialists in Taoism and Indian Buddhism and Chinese Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, Hinduism and Catholic Judaism, you know, and so forth and so on. And a lot of those people are really interested to work with people in the professional schools, partner up with health scientists to do scientific research, work together with neuroscientists in the psychology department, work together with the School of Education on thinking about how to adapt these things in teacher training. We'd like to make that the hallmark of our work, that we put humanist, contemplative people, contemplative practitioners, and scientists and professional school people involved with application together in fruitful partnerships where we're mutually respectful, mutually engaged, and trying to work towards a greater effect than we could ever possibly do by ourselves. So
that's wonderful. We just have a couple minutes left. One question for you. Do you have concerns about the because the humanist side of the equation, just across the board, not just in this situation, but in so many fields of life and study, is sort of being squeezed in many ways by contemporary conditions. So when you bring on this heavy, you know, the power of neuroscience, the intensity of professional schools and the kind of role they play in contemporary, you know, capitalist culture, all this very intense, heavy-duty stuff, and then you, like, want to bring in some of these humanist questions that we've been talking about this whole program, how do you do that? How do you bring that? What is that extra element to keep it from just kind of getting absorbed into the machine, if you forgive the metaphor?
Well, I have a couple of concerns about this. One is I have a concern that we in humanity sometimes get locked away into our abstract critical thinking, critical reading, critical interpretation, and we're not quite willing to engage with people who are doing more practical things or applied things. I think that's important for us to overcome. But I think it's also important for us to realize that these types of contemplative things are not the other side of intellectual inquiry. It's not that you can do intellectual inquiry, you can sit there and vegetate and be a contemplative. That's not what contemplation is. Contemplation is also about a more nuanced, a more critical, a more engaged, a deeper form of intellectual inquiry as well. And I think we have to accomplish that. We can't just say, oh, this is all about application. That's an important part.
Gotcha.
Giving people tools and skills, they need to be more resilient, creative, you know, engaged citizens. But it's also about our core mission. Our research, our thinking, our inquiry will be better if we properly understand contemplation and integrate it into our lives. And so if it's going to produce better kids in our classroom and better kids for our society, and it's going to produce better and more rigorous, sustained humanistic inquiry, then what's the rationale for not doing it?
That's wonderful. We're going to have to end it there. David, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you both.
All right. From me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.